Did you see that problem? Did you 45?
It's not a problem. I think we should go ahead and have the people come up and then we can come.
Okay.
Space is nice and big and easy to read.
From the work session on House Bill 3245. Sorry, Ann, I didn't tell you. We're back in session.
No.
We have some folks here that want to make some comments on this one, House Bill 3245. Let's see. Are they here? Are you here on 3245?
Madam Chair, I'm from the State of Oregon Mental Health Division and the Oregon Advocacy Center. I think should have somebody here, but
I saw him here earlier. What you have, committee, is you have the Dash 1 amendments, which were supposed to address the concerns that and also affect the fiscal. I spoke to Judy James. Actually, she left me a message yesterday night saying that that with the amendments, there's an no fiscal impact now. But what the one issue that I have that needs to get resolved is there's the Dash 1s, and then I was given something that changed the language that I haven't been able to put into LC draft that you should have. It's a letter saying the following is a suggested language change for Section 3. And I sent that down to Judy James to have her consider that. So I think that's included in her analysis, and that's what I need to resolve. I haven't had an opportunity to get that into LC language. I got that late yesterday afternoon.
You wish to make any comments on this bill?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that 3-1 change that I think you're referencing is a change that the Mental Health Division has suggested to address any possible fiscal impact and to spread the burden of training to the folks that are actually doing the investigations in the county. So that was our suggestion.
Do you have any questions on that change?
And just to refresh the committee's recollection, the issue here was dealing with who does the investigation, and the problematic language was contracting. Whether or not there was any sort of problem with bias if the county had contracts with places that they were investigating and ways to get around that, because it would be a huge fiscal impact if counties couldn't do investigations of other parts of the county. So.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on this hearing, pending getting that further information. Ms. Chartel?
Thank you.
Work session on House Bill 3245 is closed. We are going to go back to the public hearing on 2335. An open public hearing on House Bill 2335.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2335 comes to you from the Judicial Department, and it's basically the Judicial Department's housekeeping bill, and I believe that we have Brad Swank here to talk about it, and he will also talk about the fact that he submitted some proposed amendments to me a couple days ago, which LC has but was not going to be able to get done in time for this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel with the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm speaking today in support of House Bill 2335, which, as Ms. Chartel has noted, is the Judicial Department's housekeeping bill for the 2001 session. Every session, we introduce a housekeeping bill that makes technical changes to the law that allows the courts to operate more efficiently and to interact with the public on a better basis. And we do it as one bill rather than a number of bills because it's cheaper and most of the stuff we put in here is not controversial. This bill has seven things that it does in relation to making the courts operate more efficiently. It splits the 18th Judicial District, which consists of Tillamook County and Clatsop counties, into two separate districts, and essentially these are already split administratively. They have their own trial court administrators that operate, and they operate as separate districts, and we budget them separately, and this would make it official that they're separate. This isn't asking for a new judge. There are two judges in each county, and they still share on a pro temporary work, and will continue to do that, but it just makes them two separate districts in the statute. The second thing that it does, and I've listed in my testimony the sections in which this is done, is it makes some changes to the publications account. The publications account is an account which allows provides for the publishing of written advance sheets and bound volumes of court opinions and to make other court information available to the public. The controlling statute is silent about using this for electronic access to these kinds of records, and we wanted to amend that publications account to make it clear that we could also use those monies to provide electronic access. And the third thing that it does is to change the name of the Supreme Court Law Library. The current statute refers to the law library in the Supreme Court building as the Supreme Court Law Library. And although we administer the law library, it's actually used by a number of government agencies and by the public, and we think it would be more clearly coincident with the mission of that law library if its name were changed to the State of Oregon Law Library to reflect that mission. The next thing that the bill does is to repeal the civil action data form. Civil action data form was enacted by the legislature in statute in the late 80s as part of tort reform, and it requires attorneys to submit and the OJ to collect and analyze information on damages in certain civil cases that are not otherwise captured in the court system. And this is information on settlements. And as written, the original requirement was unenforceable, it was unfunded, and when we started analyzing the data back in the 80s, the late 80s, we discovered that it was frequently episodic, incomplete, and contradictory on the same case. We actually started that process before we had OJIN in all the courts. We set up a separate process for doing it so it could be captured electronically, and that process is now outdated, and we've never gotten funds to do the technology, to increase the technology. The information had to be entered by clerks. It's not good data at this point and hasn't been for a number of years. Attorneys still are required to submit it. Some do, some don't, and that's one of the problems. And it's an ongoing thorn in the side of the bar and our courts, and we'd like to have it removed. Another thing the bill does is to allow judges to be personal representatives. ORSA 113090 currently prohibits judges from acting as personal representatives, even for family members. Other citizens can do this. There's a provision in the Code of Judicial Conduct that would prevent them from being personal representatives for people other than their family members. In 1995, the legislature repealed a similar prohibition that prohibited judges from acting as guardian or conservative for family members. So this would mean when your parents put you in their will to act as a personal representative and handling their estate when they died, you would be able to do that, and something judges currently can't do. Another thing the bill does is change the procedure for notice of change of a minor's name. It adds a subsection to a provision in the statute to allow waiver of notice of name change of name proceedings. Without the procedures, courts have to tell the parties that to proceed to file a motion under the ORCP for an alternative method of service, which is more expensive on the parties. This is something that's frequently used when the father is not in the picture, is gone, and the mother is wanting to change the name of the child. This matter was brought to us by a court that was concerned about the delay and added costs of this procedure upon children. Finally, it corrects an incorrect statutory reference that was brought to us by Legislative Counsel's office. It's a reference in statute to a law that's been repealed, and so the reference is changed to make it relevant. We've asked for amendments from Legislative Counsel's office, as counsel mentioned, and the amendments would do, when they're done, two things relating to the administration of jurors. One of them is it would change the process of minimum payments for jurors. Last session, the legislature passed a bill, as you probably remember, to provide that in circuit courts, jurors receive the minimum wage for their third and subsequent days in jury service. And in implementing this, one of the things we realized is that's going to be an incredible problem to do that on an hourly basis and to try and keep records on an hourly basis for jurors, because, you know, they're not always, they come in the morning to the jury clerk, but they're not always dismissed by the juror, which would mean if we do it on an hour-by-hour basis, we would have to have hourly records for them. So the amendment, when it comes in, would change that to having it done on a half-day basis, which would make the record-keeping a lot easier and more manageable for our courts. And finally, the amendments, when they come in, would establish a process for challenges to the selection of jury pools. This has been an issue for a while, but in December of last year, there was a Brownhill decision that came down from the Oregon Supreme Court that may allow, give attorneys the right to obtain what we currently consider confidential information for jurors to challenge the composition, how we put together the jury pools, not an individual jury, but the pool, the master and term lists that we put together. In the Brownhill decision, the court noted that the statutes offer no explanation as to how to obtain the information that might justify the kinds of challenges that the statute contemplates. The decision also made it unclear as to the confidential nature of this information that we've been keeping confidential on jurors for a long time, which includes their address, how to get a hold of them, and their name. What the amendments do is put in a process for attorneys to get the information so they can make these challenges. It's a motion process that's similar to what the judge and it also establishes protections for the remainder of the information so they don't take the information that they've got and put it on the internet or do something like that. There's still protections for the jury information, and the protections and process are similar to what the judge used in the Brownhill case that the Supreme Court allowed. Once these last two sets of amendments, particularly the one for challenges to the process for selecting the juror pool, are done, once the amendments are available, we'd like a brief interval of time to run these by the defense bar and the prosecutors to make sure that they're all right with them, since they haven't had an opportunity to look at them. That way, the committee would have either a consensus that they should go forward as they are, or at least what the policy issues would be if there are disagreements. So that's our housekeeping bill. Those are the amendments we would like to add. We would have gotten them in earlier, except the decision that these were important enough issues to add was only made at the end of last week. So that's where we are. I'm ready to answer any questions, and I'm sorry to go through that so quickly. I know it's early in the morning.
Thank you. Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad, for my sense of curiosity here, to rename, I'm wondering how long has the Supreme Court Library been called the Supreme Court Law Library? You didn't mention what statute, the time-wise. Oh. What year?
Chair Walker, Representative Backlund, actually, I don't know. It's been quite a while. I don't know how long it's been in the statute named as the Supreme Court Law Library, but I assume quite a while. I don't think those are statutes that are amended all that frequently.
Follow up? Brad, I'm just wondering, I noticed that the bill would take effect July 1 of next year, and even a simple name change, I presume, has some cost because of stationery and that sort of thing. I'm hoping you can assure me that this will not be another Nissan. So for years it was Datsun, and they switched to Nissan. They spent millions and millions of dollars to advertise that fact. We're not going to have that problem in the state of Oregon, are we?
Chair Walker, Representative Backlund, actually, we believe that everything that we've added to the bill and are proposing adding to the bill has no fiscal impact to it, and this is something we would work in the regular course of what's done with the Supreme Court Law Library. I don't think there's any cost associated with that we've identified.
I assume that, but I just wanted it for the record. We're not going to have a Nissan Datsun.
We've added it. The last statement on the testimony is that we don't believe there's any fiscal impact, so you've got it on the record in two places.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that wanted to testify on House Bill 2335? Okay, we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2335 and wait for amendments. Hearing on House Bill 3912. Counsel, will you give us a summary, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see from your very abbreviated staff measure summary, what this bill does is it modifies the provisions relating to organized communities. One of the reasons that I didn't go into more detail is because the proponents of the bill have submitted amendments to LC, and those have not arrived yet, but my understanding is they replace the original bill. I've taken a look at the draft that was provided to me, but that's not the final edition. But I think it would make sense to have the proponents of the bill describe the process as to how they got here and what their intent is. I'd also let the committee know that there is a related bill in the business committee tomorrow, scheduled for a work session tomorrow. So I think we should have a discussion on with the proponents of this bill about House Bill 2792 also.
Okay, thank you. David Bennett, Rich Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Bennett. I'm a lawyer with the firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein and have been a member of the Condominium Working Group. We've had various names from it from 1973, when we first started to make the first amendments to the Condominium Act. The Condominium Act in Oregon came into existence in 1963. Its first substantial amendments were made in 1975 legislative session. In 1981 legislature, this committee introduced the Planned Community Act at the instance of Betty Niven, who was the State Housing Council chair at the time, and the president, the national president of Community Associations Institute, who happened to live in Eugene, who felt there should be a statutory framework for planned communities as well as condominiums. We have listed in the material, I think, which has been furnished you, people who serve on this committee. There's a substantial number of lawyers, but if you would permit me, I'd like to just briefly tell you what they do. Gene Grant is a lawyer primarily representing developers. He also happens to be the mayor of Happy Valley. He's done a lot of high-rise condominiums in downtown Portland. Rich Vile, who's to my right, has been working in condominiums since he first started practice in 1980. He also owns a number of condominium units. He currently primarily represents associations. I represent both associations and condominiums. And condominium developers. My partner, Connor Gustafson, basically represents associations. Denise Bauer is a property manager representing master associations, condo associations, and planned communities. Barbara Kahns, who's a project manager with Rich Vile's office, was formerly with a title insurance company, and before that was a condominium review officer with the real estate agency for more than 10 years. Diane Wood is a property manager representing associations, both condos and planned communities. Howard Feuerstein is a lawyer who's been on the committee since I have in Portland. He primarily represents developers. Rich Thompson has been on the committee and does come to the committee meetings, is a specialist, a consultant in reserve studies for associations. Dave Schwent is a CPA. I'm not sure he sat this time, but he has on reserves and tax matters for associations. John Gibbon is a lawyer, a single practitioner who happens to also live in an association. He is on the board from time to time. From time to time, he's not, and at odds with the board. Brian DeMarco is currently the condominium review officer for the real estate agency. And Linda Triplett, who is a lawyer, used to be in Portland. She moved to Baker City and still is very active in this area, primarily representing developers. one of the things that's really important, I think, for the committee to understand is that over the years, we've had to be sure that one size doesn't fit all. I've done condominium developments from a duplex to 300 units. I've done planned communities, planned unit developments from 3 units at a townhouse to hundreds of units. And by way of example of how this works, I'm currently doing an 8-unit condominium in Kaiser of 2 fourplexes, which is part of an association called Inland Shores East, which is part of an association called Stats Lake, which has a floating homes association potential with it, and we're putting a condominium on top of it. So it's very important that we don't have one size fits all, and I think the balance of our committee over the years has tried to recognize that. All of us, Rich and I and many others, represent individuals who have disputes with homeowners associations, as long as not the ones we represent, and are very aware of the kinds of issues that arise, and we've tried to keep that balance. I just wanted to kind of let you know who we were and what we've done. All of us who are testifying today are active in Community Associations Institute, which is a national organization formed, I believe, in 1968 or something like that. I was the founding, one of the 2 founders of the Oregon chapter in 1980. That association consists of developers, public officials, boards of directors, homeowners, property managers, and bankers and lawyers and the like. All of us attend the National Law Seminar on it. The National Association has many, many developers, many, many boards of directors, and many other individuals. So we have a lot of exposure nationally to various kinds of legislation, including the Uniform Condominium Act, which is adopted in Washington, the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, which started out in Connecticut, happens to be adopted in Alaska, where we also have an office. So we've worked with a lot of different things. Now, I think a lot of the things you have to look at are the policy issues between the things that we've done in this bill, the other parallel bill that's been proposed, and have to ask yourself, what, as a policy matter, do we want to do? Certainly, we have no monopoly as a committee on good law, good ideas, but we're broadly based and have a lot of different experience to see the various things that have arisen over the years, and we try to reflect that. There is a lot of tension in our committee when we meet. Sometimes we yell at each other when we disagree, and my good friend Rich Vile here and to the right, often we do have a very great difference of opinion, one of which in this bill we had Robert's Rule of Orders, which I'm not really in favor of, but we reached an accommodation to put it in because most people don't know Robert's Rules. And so one of the things we did, but a lot of people don't proceed according to any sort of rules. So one, our compromise was we put it in, but provided that if the association itself or the board didn't proceed according to Robert's Rules of Order, that the decision they made would still be effective unless a person objected at the time, and that objection was based on the fact that they didn't have a right to weren't allowed to participate, and they had a right to participate. Because I don't want to have an association later on having made a bunch of decisions and then come back and find out that they're not effective. And last legislative session, we had a curative provision with respect to decisions and documents were recorded, that those documents are effective even though there might not have been the proper approval, unless on the face of the document it demonstrates that the proper number of people to approve it weren't procured at the voting thing. So we don't want to have a fabric that falls apart from all these things. In the parallel bill, I mean, one of the things I'll just point out to you, there's a proposal that the association, both condos and planned communities, have office hours 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. Well, this would have to do with 2-unit condominiums and 20-unit planned unit developments and the like, and the large associations do have business hours, either through their manager or their own association, but smaller associations certainly would not. So,
which I think is being amended in that bill.
Right, yeah. That is that. So I'm going to be quiet and let you say a few things.
Please state your name for the record.
Richard Vile, offices in Portland, and I'm also a lawyer. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm grateful for the opportunity to address you for just a moment on this. I'd like to tell you that I believe the primary purposes, the 2 primary purposes of our bill
are, first of all, to bring under the statutory framework of homeowner association regulation most of Oregon's non-condominium projects. By way of just a bit of history, in 1969 we got our first real comprehensive condominium act, and many projects were developed as condominiums, but developers soon realized that they did not want to be regulated by the real estate division. And so what we call common law homeowner associations or common law common interest property projects began to spring up. In 1981, when the Planned Community Act was adopted, the proponents of that act nonetheless carved out what are called de minimis associations. If you had a certain level of assessments or you had few units, you didn't have to comply with the act. Well, interestingly, most developers figured out how to come under the de minimis provisions, and since 1981, it's our estimate that only about 5% of the homeowner associations developed in Oregon have actually been regulated. The rest were done without any statutory oversight whatsoever. So most projects, I was talking to Representative Ringo last night up at a town meeting that he had in Beaverton. He lives in Waterhouse, which is a project up in the Portland area that is not regulated. It was developed by the developer without the benefit of any statutory regulation. Our bill would bring under the ORS Chapter 94 provisions any association where the ownership wanted to have the benefit of statutory constitutional type provisions to assist them in governing their association. And in addition, it also brings the non-condominium homeowner associations and the condominium homeowner associations in line with one another so that the constitutional framework, the statutory framework under which they all are governed, are essentially the same. The same sorts of rules on what percentage of votes it takes, the same sort of rules on how meetings are held, same sort of rules on Robert's Rules of Order, as David was just talking about, will apply to both types of projects. This is a very important step forward in ensuring that someone who moves from one project to another is not confused by the fact that there is different law or perhaps no law at all applying to this project. I'd like to just briefly mention the fact that we have been very aware of Ms. Harriet Heise's bill, which is currently before the business committee. I've talked with Ms. Heise. We do disagree on a number of things. However, we have attempted to incorporate into our bill a number of the things that Ms. Heise has proposed. For example, Ms. Heise was concerned as an individual owner about the fact that in her association there was no schedule of fines, and the board apparently just decided on their own without any real deliberation that they would fine somebody, I don't remember the number, $300 for an architectural violation, without any advance notice that that might be the process. We have included in our bill, applying to both condos and non-condo homeowners associations, the requirement that the board must establish a schedule of fines before they can be imposed. That is an example of the kind of thing that we believe is helping to balance the rights of the individual homeowner with the need to have some control by the board of directors to actually carry out the business of the association.
Well, let me interrupt you just for a second. One of the things I know that Rich and I both represent a lot of associations that he and I will not allow our association to fine anybody unless they do have such a schedule or such a resolution and go through a hearing process, which is statutorily required. So this is sort of codifying what the practice is among the better practitioners in any event, I think.
It is important for you to understand that in the homeowner association, and when I say homeowner association, I include condo associations. In the homeowner association field, the most difficult thing boards of directors have is many of the documents require, for example, a majority vote on issues, and you can't even get a majority of the folks to show up and participate, so that it becomes virtually impossible for them to conduct business where their documents require a majority vote, unless you have other means. For that reason, we've established things like mail-in ballots or proxy voting. A lot of times, it is very, very difficult for associations to move forward at all without the benefit of some of those kinds of mechanisms because you have very low participation in most homeowners associations. This is a very...
Thank you. Rich, you mentioned the mail-in ballots. I know that Harriet, I'm on that Business and Labor Committee, I know that Harriet Heise is very concerned about the mechanism or the technique or the methods of the vote. And she claims there's no security on terms of the votes. She claims that they're counted as the votes come in, and sometimes people are told, don't bother to vote, it's already been decided, or majority vote, or whatever. You mentioned that you are addressing some of Harriet Heise's concerns. Is this one of those? Have you done that?
Chair Walker, Representative Backlund, we have not, in our committee, we debated this extensively. We have not included the requirement that this mail-in ballot process be changed in any way from current form. Current law has been in existence for some time, and it does allow for these mail-in votes. I think Ms. Heise's concerns are legitimate in isolated cases, and certainly must have happened in her case. But as a policy matter, it's difficult for us to impose upon every association, for example, an absolute requirement for secrecy balloting. The cost of that in many associations is very, very expensive. Now, it is true that nothing in the current law prohibits an association from deciding, be it the board or by petition of owners, to impose secrecy ballots. For example, we just passed a secrecy ballot provision at Crooked River Ranch this last year, a large association in Central Oregon, where it will cost a lot of money, but a majority of the owners wanted it. As a policy matter, we have not proposed to the legislature that a strict requirement on secrecy balloting be included in our bill. We really appreciate Harriet's concerns on this, but as a practical matter, we believe that should remain something that that group of people decides from time to time, by democratic process, by board resolution, voted on by the members, or whatever means.
Well, thank you, Rich. I appreciate that answer. I guess maybe I'm talking about House Bill 2792 here. I guess I'm not convinced that your approach is the best one, just because there are concerns, and it seems that maybe they could be alleviated with a policy dealing with mail-in ballots, secrecy, that sort of thing. I don't know what the expense would be. You mentioned it might be pretty expensive. But it seems like if there are concerns and the bill could address them, that this might be something that might be a good thing. That's just kind of where I am right now, I guess.
Okay. Chair Walker, Representative Backlund, let me make this commitment to the committee. As you know, we have, I believe, as yet undistributed -2 amendments to this bill, and I will make the commitment to the committee that we will continue to work with Harriet on trying to incorporate those things that collectively we can arrive at a consensus on. I think it's important, Representative Backlund, to recognize, as Dave said, we've got about 20 people that actively participate on our committee, and we get knockdown dragouts on these issues. And this is one where we've had a very difficult time. If we knew that our legislators were looking us in the eye and saying, you better incorporate this one or else, I suspect we'd probably have a different discussion about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if I might just point out to the committee, and I don't believe they're signed up, but we have present with us today Denise Bauer. Denise is the current chair of the Legislative Action Committee for the Community Associations Institute chapter of Oregon. CAI, as David mentioned, is a national trade organization that deals with homeowners associations. With Denise is Don Price, formerly the board chair at On the Green Condominiums, now lives in another homeowners association. And then, in addition, Barbara Kahns is sitting next to Ms. Bauer, and Brian DeMarco of the state is sitting behind Ms. Kahns. I don't know that any of them have signed up, but if the committee wishes to hear from any of them, I'm sure they'd be happy to provide additional testimony.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Harriet Heise.
morning. Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Harriet Heisey of Bend, Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about the proposed legislation in HB 3912, and I am the author of HB 2792, which deals with many of the same statutes. However, I do not believe that 3912 improved on all of the issues that I had, and I would like to address just four of them, which I think are of paramount importance. This may seem strange that Section 49455, the definitions, you would have to go when we get to 94709 to understand the reason why I want fees, fines, interest, late charges, and the written ballot defined separately. The written ballot is a printed form on which the votes may be cast, accompanied by a secrecy envelope and a return identification envelope to be signed by the homeowner. I want that clearly spelled out in the definitions as to that's what a written ballot would be, because it will give clarity to the term whenever it is used throughout the document. In ORS 94647, which deals with the voting, I have indeed, as Representative Backlund said, the issue is the lack of the secret ballot. The double envelopes is used in state elections. The ballots are not required to state a pro or con position on the issue, nor an estimate of the cost to implement whatever it is that they're voting on. There is no provision for the counting of the ballots by impartial persons, and also allows for the counting of the ballots from time to time as they come in. Added to this HB 3912 is what they call a consent vote. And in addition to a formal meeting or a vote by written ballot, HB 3912 allows for an action that may be taken at an annual, regular, or special meeting to be passed by written consent in lieu of a meeting or solicitation of the written ballot. The action must be evidenced by one or more written consents describing the action taken, signed by all of the owners or directors entitled to vote on the action, and delivered to the association for inclusion in the minutes or filing with the association records. A consent signed under this subsection has the effect of and may be described as a meeting vote. The possibilities for manipulation and fraud are unlimited with these voting procedures, and I am asking that that be stricken out. Written consent signed by all owners entitled to a vote will be an impossibility. You cannot achieve that, even in a small development. However, written consents signed by all directors entitled to vote will allow for issues to be placed into effect without anyone ever hearing a pro or con on the issue or knowing it is in effect until it presents a problem to the community. Placing such voting procedures in effect will render the homeowner powerless against a reckless and or an abusive board. The voting statute will accomplish one thing. No more will HO advocates be able to say, if you don't like what's going on, get rid of the board. Board members will remain there and control the outcome of every election issue and action. It has been stated that one of the objections to the secret written ballot in the mail-in envelope is the cost. In the association that I live in, which is over 250 homes, there are maybe only two or three issues in a year's time, if that, that would require a write-in ballot. And that would have to do with amendment to the bylaw or changing the CC&Rs. The board of directors handle everything else at their board of directors meetings. The owners do not vote at the board of directors meetings. It would seem to me that in any issue where you need 50% or more of the votes of the homeowners to pass it, that a write-in ballot is just absolutely a necessity. As Mr. Weil pointed out, apathy reigns in homeowners associations just like it does in the general public, and it is difficult to get people to meetings. If you have a mail-in ballot, at least they will mail those in most of the time. I'm just asking that we would put into the bill provisions that are the same as we use in our own general elections. The next issue is the power of the board to levy fines for violation of the declaration, bylaws, and rules and regulations. No one is questioning.
I'm sorry, if I could stop you before you go on.
Yes, Shetterly.
I have, in my law practice, I have some familiarity with this use of consents in lieu of meetings. It's common in corporations and other business entities to have that. My experience has been that that's typically used exclusively used in non-controversial kind of decisions, because it does require unanimous consent, unanimous agreement among all persons entitled to vote. So if one person objects to the proposed action, they can decline to sign that consent, in which case then the consent doesn't go forward, and I think you would be back at a vote if the board or the members wanted to proceed. So I'm not sure what is the problem with manipulation here. I mean, one person could just say, maybe not even I'm opposed, but maybe just I don't have enough information to say I want to sign this consent. I'd like to know more, in which case that effectively puts you back at the current requirement of the mail ballot or a meeting, however, some other way. So this just seems to me to be a way to streamline the process in non-controversial decisions where you might save some money by avoiding the mail process or the meeting process. If everyone knows basically going into this that this is a decision that everyone's going to agree on, let's just get this done the most direct and least expensive way.
Well, Chair Walker and Representative Shetterly, the way this is worded, it says owners or directors. And I take that to mean that 100% of the owners, which of course would include the directors, presenting something as a consent, or 100% of the directors.
Madam Chair? I guess I would look at, and again, this is my own familiarity with this in another context, but on line 10, I think your saving language there is action is taken by all of the association members or directors entitled to vote on the action. So I think whether it's a director's consent or a member's consent is going to be determined on by what's the decision. Is this a decision that the directors have the authority to vote on in the first place, or is a decision that requires all of the members to vote? And if it's under the bylaws or statutes, whatever, if it's a decision that could be made just by the directors, then it would be a director's consent. If it's a decision that requires membership approval, on which the members are entitled to vote, then it would require a consent of all the members. So I think whether or not it would be a member's consent or a director's consent is still going to be determined by the underlying nature of the action that's being proposed and looking at the bylaws or statutes to determine who's entitled to vote on that. So I don't see this as being a way for directors to usurp a member's right to vote on an issue, because entitlement to vote on the issue is still going to be determined by reference to the bylaws or the articles or other governing documents. I guess that'd be the response to that.
Please continue. Okay. The other, 94630 is the power of the board to levy fines for violation of declaration, bylaws, and rules and regulations after giving written notice and an opportunity to be heard. No one is questioning the board's authority to levy the fines. But the board does not bear any burden of proof under the HOA statutes, and the opportunity to be heard is before the board, who is the accuser, the prosecutor, the jury, and the judge. I proposed an opportunity to request dispute resolution services and allow the issue to be heard by an impartial body. Oregon has a dispute resolution commission that can act in mediation, negotiation, and other problem-solving issues. And it is my understanding there is no cost for these services, and it is not binding arbitration. That is what I would like to see placed into the bill the use of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission to dispute issues. Many times these issues are small. They're minor items, but they are blown out of proportion oftentimes because there's not an agreement reached and there's too much personal interaction there, whereas a third impartial party might be able to mediate and settle the dispute much quicker. Then the power to lien and foreclose, HB 3912, of course, provides the lien and foreclosure of all assessments levied against the lot, including fees, late charges, fines, and interest. The power to lien and foreclose represents the power of the government and places the association in that role at that point. The lien may remain in force for 6 years. And my opposition in this area is to the foreclosure solely for fines, fees, late charges, or interest. This is an area that is documented nationwide as a problem, that oftentimes the assessment, the basic monthly assessment is paid, but because of a past problem, the fine is still out there. It is accruing interest. There's fees for other items, and the association will foreclose for those items. I am proposing that they can lien but may not foreclose solely for fines, fees, late charges, or interest. If the committee knew what problems were out there, then we would know what we are talking about here. But there's no agency in the state of Oregon that will take any complaint against a homeowners association. And I would like to see the Consumer Complaint Department of the Attorney General's Office receive and document complaints against homeowners associations. If we had statistics and facts available that would reveal the number, the type, and the depth of the problem, then legislatures wouldn't have to sit here and listen to people's beliefs that problems are developing, that they have developed, that they are rampant, or that carefree bliss reigns in every HOA. You would know what was actually going on. But again, I go back to the voting. If the voting statutes of HB 3912 remain intact, I really believe that the homeowner will lose control over their property. Total and absolute control will be in the hands of the board. The counting of the votes from time to time as they come in is a very bad provision. If the desired result of this legislation is an adversarial relationship between the board and the community, then 94-647 will accomplish that. Although nonprofit corporation laws allow most of the voting procedures that are in HB 3912, I do not believe that these procedures are conducive to promoting harmony within an organization that is dealing with people's lives and property. If the goal is harmony and an honest, well-run homeowners association, then we need to put some legislation in that will put some brakes on the boards. Realistically, all people do not wish their neighbor well, and they do not act from a moral sense of right or wrong. We have to look at that fact when we talk about legislation in homeowners associations. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Heisey? You covered it very well. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 3912? Please come forward.
Madam Chair, I'm Denise Bauer, and I'm really nervous.
what is your last name again?
Bauer, B-O-W-E-R, and this is my first hearing, so forgive me if I do something incorrectly. I'm a community manager with Vice President and Vice President of Community Management Incorporated, more commonly known as CMI. I have been with CMI for 11 years. I do hold three designations within the industry. the highest of which is called a PCAM, Professional Community Association Manager. CMI has been in business since 1972. All we do is manage community associations. Currently, we manage 76 community associations representing over 6,000 units and or lots and approximately 10,000 people. For the last 11 years, I have served on the board of directors, many of those as secretary of Community Association Institute, which has been referred to earlier in the testimony. CAI is a national nonprofit educational organization representing Americans' 205,000 residential condominium cooperative and homeowner associations, related professionals, and service providers. CAI has 17,000 members and 56 chapters throughout the United States and several foreign countries. The CAI Oregon chapter has 126 members, including individual homeowners, board members, property management companies.
Ms. Bauer?
Yeah.
Since we have your written testimony that you've put a lot of work into, could you skip down to number 8 there?
All the way to 8?
Yes,
sure.
Please.
House Bill 3912 is important for two reasons: to bring more associations under the state statutes, to provide them with the tools to have guidelines to operate, and to increase the consistency in the operations of community associations, condominiums, and planned unit developments. The Oregon CAI LAC, of which I am chairperson, has reviewed all the bills in front of the legislator, and we believe 3912 best addresses the concerns of homeowners and board of director members. There were two issues, if you will allow me to address. One is the secrecy ballot. I can just basically say it kind of isn't an issue with secrecy ballots. It's hard to get people just to return their ballot, no matter how simple you make it for them and how clearly you put it on the ballot. Just getting back enough votes to make an amendment or even getting enough proxies back to hold an annual meeting is difficult. Usually, at an annual meeting, it's difficult just to get people to serve on the board of directors, let alone get enough people to vote for the people who are on the ballot for the board of directors. Usually, it's by acclamation because there aren't even enough people to fill the positions on the board, let alone have extra people to actually have a vote on. As far as the cost involved with the secrecy ballot, that's not, although that's a concern, my largest concern is the administration of a secrecy ballot. For smaller associations, it's impractical for them to have an outside person to hire somebody to come in and count the secrecy ballots when it simply usually isn't an issue. Oftentimes, the things people are voting on are so clear that it's usually a unanimous vote. The other item I'd like to address is lien for fines. If you can lien for the fines but not act on that lien, it's really not a tool for the association. It can sit there for 20 years, and the association has no tool to collect those fines. The only option they would have is if the unit sold or the lot sold, and if it didn't sell, again, the association would not be able to collect on that lien. Thank you.
Any questions, Ms. Bauer? Okay. Thank you very much. Please state your name.
My name is Don Price, Madam Chair and council members. Like Denise, I'm a little nervous. I haven't done anything like this for quite some time. I don't have prepared remarks, but to speak to you as a past president of a homeowners association, it was a 272-unit complex, and it required quite a bit of time, effort by the board and the members of the association. The association board of directors, I feel, needs to have the statutory strength to pursue their objectives as outlined by the CCNRs or whatever documents happen to apply for that particular type of association. As you limit that, you limit the ability of the board to conduct the members' business. And the documents and the law should, I think, support that ability. In 3912, I support that because it allows people to choose to join an association. There are many associations, or not necessarily, well, associations out there that don't have documents or clear documents, and so they really have no clear representation, and it becomes a matter of person to person rather than somebody speaking for them and administrating the business of the association. As far as voting goes, just to put my last comment on that, getting the votes, even the proxies, is very difficult. In my experience in that association, we would send out proxy to all members, and about a week before the annual meeting where the voting was to take place, I and my other colleagues on the board would go door to door in order to get proxy from the members to get us enough for the meeting or to hold the meeting. That does give you some idea of the need for assistance in that. That's all I have to say. So if there are any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Price? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is there anything you wish to add?
Madam Chair, if I might just respond very
Please
briefly.
Say your name again.
Richard Vile.
Thank you.
If I might respond just very briefly to the comments of Ms. Heisey. It is important to recognize that the Board of Directors, in response to something that Representative Shetterly was bringing up, is bound by the open meeting law in Oregon. 3912 would bring all the rest of those homeowner associations that currently aren't bound by the open meeting law into that fold as well, meaning that even on issues that the board might unanimously agree upon, they can't hold that meeting other than notice, giving the owners an opportunity to show up at that meeting, and then voting on it. So I do not believe there is a concern about the board controlling owner action where that action is called for either by statute or by the documents, simply because the owners may be able to cast a unanimous consent vote. The board is still going to have to hold their meeting under the open meeting law. The second thing I want to reinforce is the point that Ms. Bauer made relative to fines, fees, attorney's fees, etc. It is often the case that an owner will violate the covenant, be given notice, a fine imposed, and they'll pay their monthly assessment, but they won't pay the fees, they won't pay the attorney's fees that the documents require them to pay if they violated it, and they'll simply say, I'm not going to pay those. If you can't lien them, as Ms. Bauer pointed out, you really don't have any ability to enforce your documents other than that lien often, or a lawsuit. If the person doesn't agree with the lien, we still have the opportunity for them to be heard in court. I don't know if this dispute resolution commission, I doubt seriously that they would want to deal with all of the homeowner association complaints that might come up. I do know that the real estate division, Mr. DeMarco is back here, receives a lot of calls from people saying, how does this work? How do our documents work? And they respond frequently by giving either some advice or referring them on to attorneys that work in this area. In addition, I don't think that the voting provisions as recommended by Ms. Heisey should be referred to the AG's office. Once again, we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of folks who, if they have a dispute with their board, are going to go to the AG's office. I'm dubious about whether or not we really want to go down that road. Again, it occurs, but it's rare that the association and the individual owner can't agree, and in those cases, we often find ourselves in circuit court. And yes, that is expensive. And I have represented boards of directors of associations who paid attorney's fees because they lost in court. I've also represented individual owners who paid attorney's fees because they've lost in court. I've also been on the other side of those. I've won a few. But it is a mechanism that does work, albeit expensively. I will tell you that I find most boards of directors, being the volunteers that they are and members of the community who've stepped forward to try and help make something happen there, to be very thoughtful in their consideration of individual owners' concerns as they are brought to them. I know Ms. Heising disagrees with me, but I represent several hundred associations, and that has been my experience in the last 20 years. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shirley.
Question. For the most part, the provisions in this bill regarding governance really establish the minimum requirements, don't they? I mean, an association could impose on itself requirements that are in addition, I guess, or you might say more protective of the owners and more limiting on the board than the minimum requirements in the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, that's exactly right. In fact, throughout the bill, those minimum requirements also are stated as unless otherwise provided in the declaration or unless otherwise provided in the governing document, this will be the standard. So you may have something more onerous in those documents. You may have from time to time something more minimal. However, from this point forward at least, developers won't be able to put anything in that's less than this minimum standard that's created. We believe that's protective of the contracts that people have entered into up until the point of this bill.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair. Again, I just raised that to point out with regard to this issue of the consent in lieu of a vote on page 15, line 6. It does begin, unless prohibited or limited by the declaration, articles of incorporation, or bylaws. So if an association, if a majority of members of an association decided they just weren't comfortable with this consent in lieu of meeting process, they could amend their bylaws to basically say that that does not apply.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3912. Three work sessions left. We have House Bill 2394. Council, would you please give us an update?
Thank you, Chair Walker.
I have the dash two.
Dash two?
No. I don't know where the dash ones were, but this is the dash two amendment.
House Bill 2394 is the bill regarding civil commitment. It does several things. It would allow a mental health investigator access to the law enforcement data system that's maintained by the Oregon State Police and would allow the use of any pertinent conviction in the investigation report. The bill would also include in the commitment order notification to the mentally ill person that's committed that they are under a prohibition against the ownership or the purchase of firearms, which is the current law. They're just not notified of it. And additionally, it would make a partnership between the mental health division and the law enforcement data system for the sharing of information on individuals that are under current commitment. It's anticipated that it would allow the LED system access to the mental health database for this limited purpose. This is similar to the access that LEDS currently has to run background checks for guns. There are the Dash 2 amendments that were prepared to address concerns raised by the Mental Health Division about the security of the information and the proper use of it by the law enforcement community. The access through LEDS would be limited to law enforcement officers.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I think Margaret Taylor was anticipating some additional amendments. Is that right? I'd be curious, if you wouldn't mind hearing
from her,
I'd be curious to hear what that is. I don't know.
Hi, Madam Chair. I'm Margaret Taylor. I've worked at the Psychiatric Crisis Center for 3 years, as well as working at the jail. And I had a minority bill that was originally produced as part of the interim committee. And then later I talked to Max Williams, and we put together a set of proposed amendments that incorporated features from that minority report into House Bill 2394. And I have a copy of that set of amendments here. Max had mentioned that he was going to move them, but I don't have them, and I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the rush and pressure, actually, this is bringing a lot of memories to mind as I watch you struggling with these important decisions on very little sleep. At the Psychiatric Crisis Center, we do 6,000 screenings every year. So you look pretty close to how I look at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning when I'm seeing an individual coming in that's obviously mentally ill, and I'm trying to make a decision of whether a hold needs to be placed on the individual or not.
Madam Chair, I'm just want to know if Margaret means that we look obviously mentally ill.
Exhausted. Just exhausted. Okay. Is there anything else you wish to say about these amendments?
The main point is that the time that the hold needs to be placed on the individual is when they're there at the hospital. 103 people were placed on a hold, civilly committed in Marion County last year. 103 of them came in through the hospital. So if you don't have that information right at the assumption when they're in at the hospital, the person won't be placed on the hold. I'm sure you've heard about the Pacific Gateway and the incident that happened up there. There's incredible pressure on hospital beds. Many, many people that come through probably need to go to the hospital. We have to decide who's going to get that one or two beds that may be open that night. And a person who is a danger to themselves by indicated by their criminal history should have preference in terms of public safety for that bed.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Do you have any comments, Representative Williams?
Madam Chair, I'd simply move the adoption of the amendment.
Which one?
The one that you just talked about. Isn't that why?
Dash 1 or Dash 2? We're just
giving Dash 4.
The
Dash
1. Dash 1.
Yeah, Representative Shetterly.
Madam Chair, Representative Williams, this is the amendment Margaret's bringing forward. We're just seeing it now, giving community mental health and developmental disabilities program directors or designees access to LEDS for the purpose of making a probable cause determination.
Right.
We're going to recess for a moment.
Yeah.
The bags under my eyes.
My daughter was up during the night, so.
Yeah, Teresa.
Once a week.